Topic 1, the South and Civil Liberties. Your host, Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. Today we're going to look at civil liberties in the South and hear from Charles Morgan, Jr., a Birmingham, Alabama attorney who is Executive Director of the Southern Regional Office of ACLU in Atlanta, Georgia. We also have with us today in the studio Henry Pickett, Jr., the only Minnesota attorney to devote his summer vacation in 1965 to going to the South and working with the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee of ACLU defending civil rights and civil liberties cases in the South. The American Civil Liberties Union is an organization of 75,000 people. We have 35 affiliates, of which Minnesota is one. Our 2,000 members in Minnesota and many of the other affiliates in the North, the East, and the West have a large enough membership to support their programs and to work with the national office. However, we have a unique problem in the South. The problems of civil liberties are severe in many areas of the South, and our membership and our affiliates in the South are small and unable to maintain a program by themselves. So in September of 1964, the affiliates and national office agreed to get together and establish a Southern Regional Office of ACLU. This office opened in September under the direction of Charles Morgan, Jr., as its executive director. Chuck was a successful lawyer practicing in Birmingham, Alabama for many years. About 2 years ago, when the church in Birmingham was bombed and children were murdered, Chuck spoke out publicly. As a result of this speaking out, he was subjected to personal threats and harassment, both to his family and to himself, and suffered economic loss in his practice of law. As a result of this, he had to leave Alabama. He returned to the South as executive director of the Southern Regional Office, and in an address to the annual meeting of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, about the time that the Southern Regional Office started its work, he spoke to us and described the South and civil liberties problems in the South. We'll hear from Chuck Morgan and then discuss with Henry Pickett his experiences working for the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee of ACLU in the South this past summer. Now, Charles Morgan, Jr.
Now, I must mention to you that my environment and background is somewhat different from yours, and consequently my view of life is a bit different, and my view of the South is a bit different, I'm quite certain, from some of the ideas that you have. I know that race is the central theme of Southern life. It has been the central theme of Southern life, and it will for some time be the central theme of Southern existence, political, economic, social. The South centers on the race question. The Deep South, more than other sections of the South. I know this, and I know that from this single question, there arise all of the civil liberties problems you have, plus all of the additional problems that they have in the South. For instance, if you're worried about prayer in schools, you haven't got a single problem here that they haven't got there, because you name the county and you name the school district, and they've got prayer in schools. As a matter of fact, in one district in Georgia, I was putting my son in school there, and I discovered that in one of the school districts, they pray for the state of Georgia. I'm almost willing to engraft an exception on the ruling for that purpose, but not quite. Now, working for the American Civil Liberties Union in the South may be a little difficult. Some people have asked me about how Atlanta is as a place to have an office. Atlanta is that place in the South that if you were flying from Mississippi or Alabama to New York or Washington, and you didn't have a layover in it, you'd get the bends. It's not that it's so good, it's not that it's so bad, it's just one big decompression chamber, and it is the grandest place to be. But there are still problems. For instance, if you go there for the American Civil Liberties Union and you tell someone what you're doing, they say, "For who?" And you can understand their chagrin because you see the words that are involved. American is not too well regarded in some sectors down there. civil has become a pretty bad word along the way. Liberties isn't too good, and union they ain't had none of in some places ever. Now, I know you think people down there are different from people elsewhere. They're not. People are people wherever they are. Those people are trapped, many of them, and those people have different sorts of problems from other people. I know that in Birmingham, where I lived, I know some young lawyers who had to give up their positions with the law firm because they were involved in negotiating simply a settlement of the May demonstrations and in trying to ameliorate racial difficulty. They were given an option: continue with your activities or quit. It wasn't quite put in those words. Good law firms don't do that. They left. Another young lawyer with a good-sized law firm there. And by the way, I want to mention to you that a great amount of legal business goes south from the north, and a great amount of it is funneled into those lawyers who, if they recognize the existence of the Supreme Court of the United States, if the Supreme Court of the United States bit them on the leg, they wouldn't understand that it existed, let alone other. One young lawyer there wrote a letter to the State Superintendent of Education. It was a nice letter. It was one page. It was very moderate and temperate. And it was the sort of letter, you know, like this: if we haven't had a lot of prayer in schools before — the governor had just made another one of his brave statements. He was through waltzing in the schoolhouse door. And he had then issued a restatement after the Supreme Court prayer decision that he was going to go into every classroom in Alabama and personally read the Bible, and they would not lay their, quote, filthy, end quote, hands on him, which was a very brave remark. And at that point, the young lawyer wrote a letter to the State Superintendent of Education and says, why require prayers for the simple purpose that they've ruled the other way? And the letter came back to him and to the eight members of his law firm. And a short while later, someone came in and said, we'd like to see all your personal correspondence for the last year. And in my office, he came and we had coffee. And you know, lawyers, both personally and sometimes with clients, give sort of flip advice. I have one lawyer friend there who got a call one day saying, "Lawyer so-and-so, my husband John's off with another woman. What'll I do?" And he was tired, I guess, because over the phone he says, "Well, I don't know. When he comes home, shoot him." And she called back about 4 hours later and says, "I'm down at the police station. What do I do now?" So the summary of our discussion was, ask to see their personal correspondence for the last year. And he's in Chicago now with an excellent law firm. I know that in the South and in Birmingham, the peaceful, nonviolent Negroes, one of them, an attorney, the dean of the Negro attorneys in our state, has not left his automobile in more than 20 years without the cold steel of pistol in his hand. I know that many people in Birmingham have looked through the Venetian blinds in the middle of the night when they heard a car out front. Their dogs, when they barked at night, they weren't urged to be quiet. They were allies. I know that the searchlights outside some houses, people sometimes wondered whether they ought to be there because you might be a better target. I know that through this, people have lived in an unreal world. But for the average person in Birmingham, life was pleasant, life was good, they weren't involved. Demonstrations downtown, that's downtown. Not on that nice little green plot of grass we've got in the suburbs. Now, one of the great problems, I think, in American life is that people in the suburbs, and the good, kind, gentle people, the ones who graduate from college, get married, get an apartment, get a little green plot of grass, get a good job, work for the day when they can have two martinis at lunch, the high aims and goals maybe of Thursday afternoon golf, have their daughter marry a bright young man, not too bright. And then go through life until age 65, when they then would reside upon Social Security, against which, of course, they voted during their entire lives. For these people, the worst word in the world is controversy. That's the bad word. He's controversial. He's this. It's a terrible word. Now, for these people, though, who are not participants, the world is a sweet, kind thing. Some of you, and I've chatted with you, have visited in Birmingham. know that what I speak of is true. But for the others, life was different. And why was it? Because it was a community isolated. It's a community where they read the 12 articles on the Negro in the North by Harry Ashmore, but they didn't read the 13 articles on the Negro in the South by Harry Ashmore. Columnists in the two papers, they went from Marcus Childs or Lippmann, you name it, even Drew Pearson, they were dropped over a 10-year period. They began to disappear, and the oracles of the community became Henry J. Taylor and that noted constitutional authority, David Lawrence. And if all you read is David Lawrence, you become absolutely certain before you're through that the 14th Amendment not only is not constitutional, but it doesn't really exist. It, like Mr. Lawrence and perhaps the race problem, is merely a pigment of their imaginations, and they don't know. They really don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. And let me give you some more examples. They didn't see the white paper on CBS or on NBC on the sit-ins. They didn't see Who Speaks for the South on CBS. They didn't see ABC's Walk in My Shoes. Now, I saw ABC's Walk in My Shoes. It had been advertised in the paper, and it was scheduled, and suddenly it was canceled. The day it was canceled, 10 community leaders, including me, and I really wasn't a community leader. There were 9 others, and I was the loudmouth. We were invited up for a private showing so we'd all understand why it wasn't shown. And I watched it. It was a pretty good show. And we got through and went out to the club, and we had, 20 drinks. I don't know how many before the station manager brought it up. And then he says, "You understand why we didn't show this, don't you?" And everybody understood. It was obviously communist-inspired. It would have only stirred up trouble in the community. And, of course, I told him, "Let them kick their TV screens out, but show it. They own their sets, but show it." But they never saw it. It was not just prejudice that met people in the streets of Birmingham in demonstrations. It was ignorance. And this exists not just in Birmingham, but all over the South. And people all over the country add to it. The cab driver in New York who talks a certain way when he hears a Southern accent. And that person goes South and they have a new race relations expert and a new expert in the North. When George Wallace gets X number of votes in X state, everybody back down home says, "You know, they really agree with us." I'm absolutely convinced that a great percentage of the people in Mississippi almost had heart failure on election night because they knew that on the race question, which they were thinking about, even if some others weren't, they knew that the country really was beginning to agree with them. And this exists not just with whites, it exists with Negroes. For the average person in the South, the average housewife, the racial expert is the maid. And the maid says, I heard a friend of mine, the wife of a state legislator, kept saying, "My maid doesn't agree with Martin Luther King or Fred Shuttlesworth. She's not with them. They don't like them. My maid tells me that." And I kept saying to her, "Look, your maid's lying to you." "And I reckon your maid's got a constitutional right to lie to you because everybody else lies to their employer, so why can't she?" Well, she didn't understand this. So naturally, she went maybe to 40 cocktail and bridge parties and the same conversational pattern, "My maid, my maid, my maid." Well, one ABC show did get through, and there on the front row at Fred Shuttlesworth's church was her maid. And she saw it, in keeping with the Southern tradition of paternalism, she had to fire the maid, of course. It was a very difficult decision, but it was rapid. People don't say what they mean. People don't talk the way they ought to talk. And folks down there, they come north for a sales meeting, and everybody says, "Well, you know, you've got a peculiar problem down there. We understand how it is." But people don't like to be disliked. I know, I'm disliked. People don't like it. And they want to be a part of the society. They want to be a part of America. But they're looking for rationalizations, for new fictions, new ways. The civil rights question is not just a Southern problem, and the answer is not just a Southern solution. Because of the newspapers I named, one was Scripps Howard, one was Newhouse. Of the two television stations in that city, one is Taft Broadcasting, and one's Newhouse. Now, the decisions, if you ask them about these decisions, they'd say, well, we leave local policy up to the local editor or the local manager. And with respect to the newspapers, say Scripps Howard, that's true, except it's not true when you have editorials on the tax cut, and it's not true when you have editorials on Medicare, and it's not true when you have editorials on the presidential race. It's only true on race. But when it's race, it's local, because race is controversial and it's tough. Now, someplace in the North, some decisions have got to start making some decisions. The management and ownership of property places with it a responsibility with respect to the South. The conversational patterns in the North, a responsibility with respect to the South. Now, many people mix up, many people ask me, someone this afternoon says, how long will it be? Well, I don't know what they're talking about, because there are two problems here. One of them is the problem of the law and equal rights in the South, and the other is the problem of the hearts and minds of men. Now, on the hearts and minds of men, most of the people that I hear talk about this have heart trouble or mind trouble. I'm not particularly concerned, and I don't think most Negroes in the South are particularly concerned with whether or not somebody loves them. They want to vote. They want a job. They want a cup of coffee. They're not concerned with whether somebody loves them or not. We've got to take care of the first steps first, and then we've got to rely on people to work the problems out after that. Now, we have in the ACLU in the South, we'll have real problems. We'll have problems procuring counsel. For a white lawyer in the South, for instance, if you ask him to handle a controversial case, you'll have a real problem. So will he. In the North, everyone wants somebody in the South to speak out. It's a very difficult thing. He's pledging maybe his life and his fortune in exchange for his honor. The Negro lawyer who takes a case, it presents great problems to him, but he at least goes back to his community somewhat of a hero. The white lawyer who takes such a case goes back somewhat of a pariah. With respect to controversial race cases, what do I mean? Well, the Fields case that Jack mentioned, Edward R. Fields wanted to have a white workers' meeting above, and I love this phrase, quote, above the car wash in Fairfield. He was enjoined. He went out and allegedly violated the injunction. He was convicted of contempt. And the question was, could he raise in the contempt proceeding the validity of the injunction, which he said was invalid on its face? Now, that's not a controversial race case. 1 year later, Martin Luther King and Fred Shuttlesworth violated a substantially similar injunction. And they, in turn, had the same problem. Can they raise it in the contempt proceeding its validity? That's a controversial race case. And that's where your problem comes. I want to mention to you the need for the North, the need for constant pressure. People talk about outside agitators and states' rights and this sort of thing with respect to race, and I can assure you of one thing, that had this matter been left up to local people, had it always been left up to the local folks to work their problems out in the South, I wouldn't be talking to you tonight about civil rights. I'd be talking to you about slavery. We'd have worked out a new way, a new rationalization, a new thought, a new justification. It would have been there. And we'd have had our apologists. We're doing our best to, you know, we know it's bad, but it's necessary. I can hear it now. Now, the Negro movement in the South came out of the churches. Where it's going, I don't know, but that's where it came from. It came out of, the white man always let the Negro have the Christian religion. It was a nice thing for him to have. He could think about the future, the world was good to him, and there was never any problem on the white side from the Christian church. For many years, you know, not now. I think in the last 3 years we've seen the church becoming an active, vibrant organization in the society. But prior to that time, the proper slogan could have been on television, go to the Supreme Court of your choice on Sunday, but go to the Supreme Court. In the South, the Negro, he meets in churches. That's where he can meet. His leaders are Dr. So-and-so and Reverend So-and-so. And an arrest, a demonstration, a time in the streets in Birmingham, it's almost an act of rebirth. It's almost a baptism. Now, there's an old poem by a fellow named Oppenheim, which is called The Slave. And I'll paraphrase it. It goes something like this. They struck the chains from the slave, and he remained a slave. Chained to sloth, ignorance, indolence, and servility. Strike the chains from a free man, and he'll be free. But that never happens, for free men strike the chains from themselves. And that's what Negroes are doing. Many white people that I know, well-intentioned, say, we're going to give them their rights. What have we got to give? They've got the rights, and they're taking them. And a lot of people resent that. Well, I'm for that. And I think in that lies much of the salvation of this nation. I know that when demonstrators are met in the streets, I know that people with new rationalizations and old premises, things are very rational to the man in the bushes with the gun in the middle of the night who's watching Medgar Evers. And when he squeezes that trigger, you see, he may really think of himself as Patrick Henry. And that's hard to visualize, but it's true. He has all sorts of different kinds of dreams and schemes and plans and bases for things. And he really believes, a great number of hims believe, they believe one thing, that the Negro is basically inferior to them. Now, when you're dealing with this, it takes a toughness in the South. And it takes a remembrance that things can change. I know in Birmingham, the Alabama Highway Patrol, the affable, friendly Alabama Highway Patrol. The folks you worried about if you'd had a drink and you were driving, or you'd look over your shoulder if you were on the highway going too fast. But you'd always say to yourself, if my wife's out alone on the highway, or if there's a flat tire, we've got somebody at least to help along the way. They changed. We got a new governor. And overnight one night, they came to Birmingham, and they came 700 strong. This time, they didn't have on soft hats, they had on hard helmets. They had little Confederate battle flags up here as an insignia. The front bumpers of the automobiles, Confederate battle flags. They carried carbines, had electric prod poles. They got out with riot guns. On the backs of the cars, and there'd been no warrant in law for this, no announcement, no legislative change of the name, but in a near Freudian slip, they weren't the Highway Patrol anymore, because in big black and yellow letters, they were state troopers. And they were state troopers. At least. And you know, people talk to me about there's an act of violence or there's a little glimmer of hope. We go so far with hope. When the kids died in the church, many people thought, this'll do it. They can't take this. But when you've tolerated bombing after bombing after bombing after bombing, you become inured to violence. I was sitting at dinner on the second occasion in 2 or 3 years with the same two men. One was Justin Finger from the Anti-Defamation League. The other was a fellow named Bob Baker from the Washington Post. We're out of my house, eating. I don't know if you've heard a bomb in other than wartime conditions, but just a dull thud off of the background. And Baker turned and he says, I think that was a bomb, wasn't it? And Finger says, yeah, I think it was. And my wife says, please pass the salt. Berlin, after the Night of Crystal in 1938, when they dragged the Jews out of the shops and the temples, must have been a lot like Birmingham and other places in the South after an act of violence. You remember Neshoba County, Philadelphia? Remember what they said? They said those three had gone to Cuba. And then they said, no, it's just a fundraising stunt. In Birmingham, the same sort of thing. The janitor did it. The Negroes did it to themselves. The little girls were sneaking a smoke in the restroom and flipped some a cigarette on the dynamite they were storing in the church. That's why it went off. Wild, weird thoughts. But if Pierre had gone into Berlin and seen his old friend Hans, he'd have probably said something to him like this after the Night of Crystal. He'd have said, Hans, Hans, what's happened here in Germany? What's happened? What about last night? And Hans would have said to him, now, Pierre, first of all, I'm no Nazi, you know that. And I'm no Hitler man. And I don't approve of what the stormtroopers did here last night. But ordinarily, the stormtroopers do a pretty good job of preserving law and order around here. And you know, we wouldn't have a Jewish problem in Germany if it weren't for the communists and the agitators. And if things were really so bad here for the Jews, well, they'd leave. They couldn't be that bad. And you know, the real problem we got here in Berlin is you French reporters coming in here from the outside. All you're doing is writing about us and Germany and spoiling our image all over the world. Now, I was particularly pleased with your award tonight for the young people who received it are part of a generation of which I, for one, think we can be proud. I'm not nearly so worried about Mr. Hoover's comments on juveniles as I am about the actions of young people living in a time of crisis. I sometimes get discouraged, as does everyone. When I was in college in the early 50s, well, 1951, in a political science course, very small seminar, some of us were worried about a United States senator named Joseph McCarthy. A young man in the class was particularly disturbed, and Professor Albert Lepofsky went out and came back with a letter. He read it to us. It went something like this. It said, "Dear Albert, you're quite correct in your recollection of our recent conversation." The letter came from a man named Lewis Brownlow. He's an author of several books, amongst them Passion for Anonymity. He was a creative genius in government. He died last September. When I was a young reporter in Washington, one day I was walking across the street from the old House office building. I was with Representative Arthur Sladen from Texas and an elderly gentleman named Colonel Maury, also from Texas. He's a relative and an ancestor of Maury Maverick. And that day we were walking across the street in 1904 or 5. Representative Sladen was worried about a school board problem in the district. He was on the district committee. And he turned to me and he said, "Have you ever seen a school board that wasn't composed of absolute nincompoops?" And at that point, Brownlow said, he responded that he hadn't. And the elderly gentleman, Colonel Maury, with gray hair down his neck, little black string tie, harumphed, and he said, "Well, I've seen such a school board, gentlemen, and my father was a member of it. When I was a little boy in Albemarle County, Virginia, I walked down a dusty road one day with him and with my hand in his, and we met three other members of the board, the fifth member being absent. And that day, the four present voted to build another schoolhouse in Albemarle County. And that day," the old man said, "he met Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. A man died last year who met a man who had met Madison, Jefferson, and Monroe. We live in a very young nation with young ideas. And with our young people in years and in mind and spirit, we can make this if we live up to our dreams and act in the youthful sense of purpose which we all must act. We can make this truly a land of greatness and the light for all the free world. I urge you to join with us and help us with that task in the South. Thank you."
That was Charles Morgan, Jr., Executive Director of the Southern Regional Office of ACLU, speaking to an annual meeting of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. This is Lynn Kastner, your host. With me today is Henry Pickett, Jr., a Minneapolis attorney, born and educated in North Carolina, receiving a law degree at Duke University, former law clerk to Federal District Judge Earl Larson, for a time Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, and now in the practice of law in Minneapolis. Mr. Pickett was the only Minnesota lawyer to devote his summer vacation in 1965 to working with the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee with 125 other lawyers around the country taking civil rights cases for ACLU in the South. Welcome to the program, Henry.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
I understand you went down in July of 1965. What kind of an experience did you have?
Well, when they called me from New York to ask me whether I would go to Tallahassee, Florida, I wondered to myself why they wanted anyone to go to Tallahassee, because I hadn't heard of any problems in Tallahassee. When I got there, I found out why they do need legal assistance in Tallahassee. There's one Negro lawyer there who is the only legal counsel available for Negroes in approximately a 2,000 square mile area of northern Florida. Northern Florida is of a very rural character. The towns are quite small, with the exception of Jacksonville, which is a city the size of Minneapolis. And the problems, in my judgment, seem to be similar to those which are faced by Negroes in such county as Lowndes County in Alabama and Sunflower County in Mississippi. In short, there are some very primitive counties in northern Florida. I had occasion to work for approximately a week on some cases in Gadsden County, Florida, which is a county to the west of Tallahassee, and the situations that I found there were almost unbelievable to me, even as a Southerner.
I understand you ran into cases of alleged involuntary servitude. I'm sure most people would find this quite unusual in 1965.
Yes, I was surprised to hear from the lips of live people in front of me that Negroes on some farms in Gadsden County are not permitted to leave the farms and take employment elsewhere. Those that do leave have to do so in the middle of the night. They can take practically none of their possessions with them, and they have been known to be brought back by their white employer literally at the point of a gun. I talked to one Negro who had this happen to him some time ago. His particular problem involved the fact that he left again in late 1964. He would not come back. His former employer had him prosecuted for various misdemeanors, and he was put on the chain gang, and his employer gave him the alternative of staying on the chain gang or coming back to work for him. The employer would have paid the fine that was levied against him in the criminal cases. But this particular Negro declined to go back to this particular farm and served a total of 5 months on the chain gang. I spent quite a bit of time investigating this particular Negro's case, examined all the documents that he had. I examined all of the records in the courthouse, and I spent hours and hours and hours talking to him, checking and cross-checking his story. In my judgment, he is telling the truth, and he was a victim of a very sophisticated form of involuntary servitude.
What, now, your tenure or your term of service is the same, as I understand, of most of the attorneys, just a matter of a few weeks. Does someone else in LCDC then take over the cases you've had an opportunity to work on and follow them through?
Well, yes, that's the theory upon which this particular office in Tallahassee is being operated. There is one Negro lawyer who is there full-time, and the files stay there, and theoretically other lawyers come in and pick up these files. The cases that I started were cases in which the client had been interviewed by other attorneys. Now, I am inclined to think that in Tallahassee they are so very, very busy that they only take, or rather only spend their time on cases which are the most pressing. And unfortunately, this particular case I mentioned and several others do not seem to be actively underway in Tallahassee as of today. which is unfortunate in my judgment.
I understand you ran into other problems of law enforcement and court official denial of equal protection. Didn't you run into the problems of criminal prosecution or sentence or criminal process being carried out in the jailhouse outside of the court?
That's correct. The problems that I ran into, in which these Negroes gave their version of what happened, were very unsophisticated forms of unconstitutional behavior by law enforcement officials. In one case, a Negro was, or said he was, and I think he was telling the truth, tried in the jail in which he was being confined, rather than in the open courtroom where the Constitution says he has a right to be tried. He was deprived of the right to call witnesses in his behalf, which is a right conferred upon him by the Constitution. He was denied the right to counsel. He was convicted with absolutely no evidence against him, according to his story, which, as I said, I believe is true. If what this man says is accurate, the judge who came down to the jail from the courthouse could be prosecuted for a violation of federal criminal law.
Well, in your interviewing the person, were statements obtained so that evidence could be preserved for a possible complaint?
Oh, yes. All the people that I interviewed, took their statements and left them in the files, and lawyers that do go down will be able to take these statements and further investigate the cases and work them up to the point where these people that have allegedly done these things can be prosecuted in civil actions in the federal court for depriving these Negroes of their civil rights. Hopefully, as I said, this will be done. The fact of the matter is, from what I can gather, is that it's not being done during the winter, largely because of the absence of legal manpower to do it. There's one Negro lawyer there. He's grossly overworked. And the only way the system can function is for lawyers to go down from the North and work on these cases. These local white attorneys are simply not going to handle these cases. They wouldn't go near them.
Well, hopefully over a period of time, Chuck Morgan in the Southern Regional Office expects to get the help and assistance of attorneys who reside in these states. Of course, we know this is going to be a long, slow procedure. Mississippi, for example, there's not one lawyer, white lawyer, who will take a civil rights case. You've described cases that involve law enforcement officers, court officials, aiding in denying civil rights to Negroes. Didn't you run into a case where a white employer was able to have someone return to the employment through a process other than law enforcement agencies, individual businessmen through credit checks or a finance company?
No, I talked to one Negro who had been brought back both ways. Approximately 10 years ago, he left Gadsden County, and the person for whom he was then working came after him with a gun on his hip and told him to get into the truck and that they were going back. Now, fortunately, in that case, a white person in the other county intervened and told the employer that he couldn't take him back that way, and so that particular Negro didn't happen to be dragged back that particular time. He was subsequently, as I indicated, prosecuted in a very sophisticated fashion for leaving, and the local merchants did cooperate, it would appear, with the white farmer and cause this criminal prosecution to be brought and to be result in a conviction. And to that extent, they were part and parcel of the system, according to our client's version of the story, which, in my personal opinion, is true. They all more or less hang together there in Gadsden County, from what I could determine. It's a very closed society, and the law enforcement there seemed to be substantially worse than anything that I'd read about. And you had the impression that they didn't even care about the existence of federal laws or the federal government. For example, when the 1964 or 5, I guess it was, civil rights voting law was passed, this had absolutely no effect on the behavior of the local registrar, who continued to keep the voting office open only from 9 in the morning until 12 at noon, and from 2 in the afternoon until 5 on a Monday. Most of these Negroes, of course, are employed on the farm, and for them to come in and try to go through this process, which always takes an entire day, means a loss of $3 wage to them. And they just, by and large, can't afford it. So it was my judgment that Gadsden County was really isolated from the mainstream of even Southern life, from what I could tell, because they just seemed to be flagrantly indifferent to law as we know it in Minneapolis, or as we think we know it.
Well, it seems that many of these cases would not have come to the attention of anyone if it wasn't for the efforts of the Southern Regional Office and the many lawyers who went to the South. Now that we've had our first year of experience with the Southern Regional Office and the first year of operation of LCDC under ACLU, we hope to pull together the material and begin publishing this and informing people throughout the country of the situation in these various areas. It's been a pleasure having you with us tonight, and I want to thank you on behalf of the station and the Civil Liberties Union for coming down.
Thank you, Lynn.
If the listeners wish to get further information about these programs or the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, we invite your comments and inquiry. Send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's MCLU, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This has been a public education production of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union.